Chapter 34. Nicky, Mondello. I sit up, rip the nylon bedsheet off my body and sigh with relief. I've tossed and turned trying to kick it off for the last hour. A dining chair with stained green padding stands next to the bed. A fan sits on it, whirring warm air. Its click-clacking is annoying, but it's not as bad as Gio's snoring. It's the worst I've heard, and between the heat, the clacking, and his snoring, I can't sleep. My fingers pinch Gio's nose. He shakes his face left to right, but I hold on tight. His mouth splutters, then a grunt rattles from the back of his throat and forces his lips to part. I swear, when I was at a farm with Dad, we saw a fat pig rolling in mud that grunted less than Gio does. He turns onto his side, muttering, wafting stale garlic around him. I cough and cover my face with my palm. Even sweat's Italian here. In the darkness, the radio alarm's red numerals flash 3 a.m. Paola will be coming upstairs to knock on the door soon. We're walking up a mountain to visit the cave of Santa Rosalia. She's some kind of saint, but I forget what for.
They've hundreds here.
People are always carrying crosses and statues, parading in the street under twinkling lights for one saint or another. A night breeze creeps through the window, and I crawl over the mattress towards it, blooming in its faint caress. Paola loaned me her red halter knit top to wear. I tried it on last night, and I loved how my shoulders looked. Even Gio whistled and approved. May as well get ready now. I don't want to be late. Gio grunts and I poke him with an elbow, then slip into my flip-flops and head for the shower. Flecks of turquoise and lemon streak the dawn sky, and stained Palermo Harbour is shimmering gold. We pause our climb of the mountain and soak in the palette that sprawls far below us. Mum has a painting above the fireplace at home. It's by somebody called Van Gogh, and the sky is brushed the seam. She bought it from a stall at the Sunday market, where everything was 2 for a tenner. Trees shade the pathway, and a cool morning breeze drifts around us. I hum our favourite song and clasp Gio's hand. He draws me to him and kisses my brow. I smile. It's paradise up here. He shrugs.
It's no more beautiful than you.
The bushes rustle and an emerald lizard flashes in the sunlight as it darts across a rock. I scream and stumble on the cobbled path, but Gio tightens his grip and saves me. A couple jostles past us, the woman pushing a blue buggy laden with bags. She throws me a dirty look. When she turns away, I stick my tongue out. A rumble of engines. Gio tugs my hand and pulls me back against the yellow and orange wildflowers that pepper the trail. A thistle scratches my leg. Don't they only grow back home? I don't see anything, in case Gio thinks I'm daft. A butterfly swirls onto my arm and flutters its blue wings before dashing on. A bus groans around the corner and drives up the middle of the road. My head snaps to Gio. A bus? Where's it going?
It go the Santo...
It go the Santuario di Santa Rosalia.
He pecks bright orange pollen from his white T-shirt, rolls it between his fingers and flicks it away. I throw my arms up into the air and pout.
You mean to say we could have got a bus instead of hiking up this mountain for 2 hours?
He sticks out his bottom lip, and I feel bad.
Oh, Gio, it's not that I'm not having fun, but it's so steep, and everyone else has left us behind.
The bus grumbles by us, its wheels heavy, crumbling stone. Shirtless men, slimy with sweat, lean glaring from open windows. Their wolf whistles cling to the dust rising from the trail and blast into our faces. Gio dips his hand into his jeans pocket.
pulls a knife, snaps the blade open and jerks his head towards them. It's like a scene from The Godfather. I grab onto his arm. Hold him in place. But his anger rages, and he shoves me back, further into the wild bushes. I'm on the edge of the cliff, so high up. The sheer drop to the ground makes me scream. My head spins, my legs weaken, and I close my eyes, force my feet back to safety. The bus is further up the dusty path. Geo is chasing it, shouting insults at the men, demanding they come out and face him. The men are laughing, pointing, and carving the air with gestures. You don't need to speak Italian to know what they mean. But, except for a glance or giggle, no one else pays them any attention. It's as if this is an ordinary occurrence. I run and catch up with him. This is ridiculous. His face is scarlet, and he's panting for breath. I grab his hand and pull him back. He must want to retreat, because his body responds and he moves away. With another yell at the bus, he turns towards me and jabs a finger in my face.
This why I no like you wear these clothes. These men think you easy fuck. It cause many problems for me.
My stomach tightens and anger burns my cheeks. My fault? I'm the reason grown men are fighting on a mountain like assholes. I made him take a knife and chase after a bus like a maniac. My fault, because I wanted to be pretty for once.
Bastardos!
He runs his hand through his hair, closes the bleed, and puts it back in his jeans.
The men, the animals, Niki!
He twists his mouth and spits a bubble of saliva to the ground. I'm just wearing the same as any other woman here, Gio. My hands tug the red top I was so proud of this morning. This is Paola's. His hands rise and clasp each side of his head.
You got the blonde hair.
My papa, he say the skin you have, it too pale. The people, they know you know Italian here. The men sniff you out like the dogs, and me have to defend the honour.
Beads of sweat drip from his chin, and his t-shirt clings to his damp skin. He peels it off and wipes the cotton across his brow, then loops it into the buckle of his belt. I bite the inside of my cheek. The staying home alone in the flat, not being allowed to go out, the horrible shapeless tent dresses, the arguments about what to wear at the beach. It all makes sense now. He's been locking me up like Rapunzel, keeping me confined and away from outsiders. That's why he preferred me in the granny dresses with my face scrubbed bare. It's not that he thought I was beautiful like that. It was the opposite. He believed it made me invisible and drab. Someone no one would fancy. Disenchantment threatens tears in my eyes. I blink them back. The sun is higher, and swirls of creamy butter melt into the turquoise sky. It won't be long now until it grows fat with heat and scorches the land. My hands fumble into my purse, and I slip my sunglasses on. When Gia walks forward, arms outstretched to gather me in, I place my palms on his chest and shove him away. He tilts his head and slowly grins. But I'm not falling for his charms. Not this time. I march up the mountain, and he dawdles behind me the rest of the way. Now and again he sprinkles the air with bellas, but I shake them off. For the first time, it occurs to me, he's really not so different from those stupid guys on the bus. All they see is blonde hair and a halter top. Maybe that's all he can see too. In this place, the real me is gradually disappearing, all my flavour melting away. Is that what I want? At the top of the mountain, We enter a small square, dotted with rickety stalls selling statuettes and trinkets. The air is different here. It's refreshing and scented with mulled wine. It's packed with people, but they talk in low whispers, as if in reverence to a higher presence. Something grazes past my calf, and I step back from a middle-aged man crawling along the ground. Gio pulls me close.
Not to worry, Nikki. Some people come from bottom to top of mountain on their hands and knees.
Why? He gives a nod to a stall holder and picks up a statue encased in clear plastic. It's a woman in a nun's brown habit, holding a skull and pickaxe. He twirls it around in his palms, then hands it to me.
This the Santa Rosalia. Long time ago, in Palermo, is very bad plague. Everybody die. Very horrible death. Nobody help us. But her, save us all.
He presses the statue to his lips, closing his eyes and kissing the plastic.
She live in this cave till she die. The people take her bones in parade, and next day, the plague is gone. People come here for the devotion to her. Some, they come on the knees, like the man you see, to give the thanks.
My fingers trace a golden thread in the white marble piece. My mum would love her. A collection of saints and crucifixes adorns her bedroom dressing table. She prays to them every night. She'd cherish an Italian edition.
Gio, let's buy this.
He drops his shoulders and turns out his pockets. There's only the bleed and a strip of chewing gum.
I know I have the money on me, Nikki.
I sigh. He never has money. Everywhere we go, he pleads poverty. But he's out every day and night working. What's he doing with the money he makes? There are no casinos or bookies here, so he's not frittering it away gambling. Anyway, he said he'd never do that again. Not after last time. He'd not break that promise.
We come next week. We buy then,
he says. But it's not good enough. I want it now, right at this moment. Otherwise, it'll be tarnished with the memory of his cheap excuses. But wait, he's been mentioning a surprise for us. Something that's going to make us happy. That he just needs a little more time to make it happen. I bet it's our own restaurant. That's why he's skint. He's saving, trying to make up for the past. I tug at my shorts. I look down, imagining another damp body. But my eyes meet the top of Francesca's brown curls. I gather her up into my arms, and she hands me some crumpled money.
Mama, she say, buy the Santa Rosalia.
I look across the square, past all the different people, until I see Paola. She's standing at the steps of a cream church that's built into a wall. She smiles and weaves over. She must have been watching me and Gio and seen the discussion. She knew we didn't have the money. My lashes glisten with tears, and I shake my head to show that I can't accept her kindness. She shoves her hands onto her hips and nods her head up and down, indicating a must. Francesca giggles in my arms, and Gio takes the money from her hand and slips it to the stall holder. He doesn't have the same conflict or pride. I wrap the statue in the tissue paper that hangs from the stall and place it gently into my bag. I'll write and tell my mother later all about it. Goosebumps spring onto my skin, and I exhale a deep breath as we enter the cave. I hold up my hand, and Gio clutches my palm to his chest.
Wow. Just wow.
I whisper. In front of us stands a white marble statue,
back lit in a blue haze. At her feet are hundreds of written notes, and she's draped in strings of pearl and ruby necklaces. Jew explains they are all thank you notes and offerings from people she's helped. The flickering light of more than a dozen candles bathe her glory. I'm not religious, but even I sense the serenity within these musky walls. A mass is underway. The congregation pat their brows as drops of water splash from brass pipes in the ceiling. Geo leads me towards a glass display, and my breath stills. Santa Rosalia reclines inside, gold and white marble sparkling under artificial light. She holds her own skull in her hand and a pickaxe for hacking her way through rocks in the cave. Such beauty. How Mum would love to be here with me. There's a squeal of voices and a rush of bodies crowd into the cave beside us. It's a slap to the senses. Too boisterous for the presence of whatever rests in this place of worship. I turn to Geo and whisper, "What's going on?" Far too loud, he replies, "Italians, we know like the rain." Oh my God. Rain? I bounce on my feet and clap my hands. Finally, after months of harsh sunshine, Santa Rosalia has answered my prayers. I push and weave in and out of the bodies, blocking the exit. Them going one way, me the other. They smack their lips together and groan, as if I'm stealing their parmesan. Geo follows me and shouts my name, asking me to come back, to slow down. I ignore him. Stallholders cover their wares in sheets of thin blue plastic. Others pack their trinkets into wide wicker baskets as the rain, the glorious rain, pummels around them. I throw my head back, stick my tongue out to taste it, and descend the stairs. Within a few seconds, I'm drenched, clean, fresh, soaked to the bone. Spreading my arms out wide, I circle around, sacrifice myself to more. Someone shouts, "You crazy! You die out here, catch pneumonia or more!" When some more join in, I pause. An audience has gathered at the top of the church steps. Most of them scowl or stand with their arms crossed. Geo is in the middle, with an eyebrow raised in concern. I laugh and shout up, "Come down, Geo, and join me! It's so cool! No more sticky pollen! No more sweat!" He shakes his head, and someone pats him on the back, as if giving him condolences for having a psycho girlfriend. Maybe I've gone too far. Embarrassed him in front of all these people. Worse than that, made him look less than a man. Someone who can't control his woman. He won't like that. But then, footsteps flutter down the stone, and Paola runs towards me. Mascara smudged under her eyes, hair wet and stringy. She's never looked so beautiful. We glance at each other and giggle. My heart fizzes and flutters with joy. She clasps her hand at my waist and places mine on her shoulder. In the sweetest voice, she sings the first lines of Elvis Presley's "Return to Sender." And since my mum's a huge fan, I know every word and join in. Then, with a nod and a smile to each other, our feet splash through the puddles and we waltz around the square. The rain drowns our misgivings, and it's just me, her, and fresh mountain air.
Chapter 35. Mrs. Hawthorne, Edinburgh. "Tell me, Charles, why don't you watch television with me anymore?"
"Pardon?"
"I find things you'd enjoy all the time, and you say yes, but then never come and join me."
"That's quite untrue."
"We're in the garden eating cheese omelettes for lunch. I usually add ham to mine, but I can't handle the guilt of eating meat anymore. It's not as if he ever says anything, but his eyes narrow and his lips move a fraction before snapping tight. The unspoken words flavor my meal with his distaste. This way is better, less stressful, and I sneak a burger when I'm out shopping with my sisters. The garden's losing its summer blush, and the cold nip in the air has snatched the light from its fading blossom. Even the willow is bare and neglected. Leaves litter the lawn in brown and fawn. Charles mutters at something in the newspaper, turns the page, and I wrap my cardigan tighter around me. Jack scrambles up, pushes his nose in my lap, and I dip a hand into my pocket for his treat. He runs off happily, munching away. When my sisters and I were young, we danced in autumn, up and down hills in Prince's Street Gardens. Dad chased us. Mum stood by, biting her nails and begging him to slow down before one of us fell. We'd laugh, run faster, kicking and crunching through the leaves. I loved the crackles under our feet, the snap of the dried leaves, the giggles of our youth. Even if I could be bothered now, it wouldn't sound the same. I cradled a cup of tea to warm my hands and try again. Charles, what are you doing every night in the summer house? The place I've never been allowed to decorate. The place that's always locked. He peers over his glasses, closes the newspaper, and lays it down on the table. The smell of leftover egg catches my breath. Just listening to music, or playing piano, that's all. But you're in there for ages. Sometimes I read. I gather and stack the plates, place the dirty cutlery on top. The dredges of tea are sloshed into the lavender bush, then I hook the cups on my fingers. But we don't spend any time together, Charles. He laughs. You do say such silly things. Let me help you there. It's about to rain. I sigh. Even laced with laughter, his tone is dismissive. At first, he went in to practice piano once a week, for an hour or so. It annoyed me because I'd love to have heard him play, but he said he wasn't good enough for an audience. I attempted to persuade him otherwise on many occasions, but always failed. Lately, he practices a lot. I rinse the remnants of egg from the plates and pop them into the dishwasher. I won't switch it on yet. I'll wait until after dinner. I walked into the summer house once, just before I moved in, to ask him what he wanted for lunch. He was startled, as if he'd forgotten who I was. Now he keeps the door locked, even when he's in there. I finish wiping down the worktop, and Charles hands me a glass of white wine.
Shall we watch that new sci-fi film you mentioned last week?
He says. It's a tad early for wine, but I take a sip anyway, nod my agreement, and follow him through. I shouldn't have to push him to want to spend time with me. During the day it's fine, but in the evenings he disappears and, like that night after dinner at his friend's, the strains of her funeral song drift from the garden to taunt me. For the last week, he hasn't come to bed. For some reason, we don't discuss it. Jack jumps up onto the sofa, and I let him curl around my feet. His fur is soft from his bath this morning. He nudges his nose into my pocket, and I relent and give him another snack. Charles smiles, reaches for my hand, lifts it to his mouth and kisses it. Something's missing from the bookcase. I can't quite place what it is. All our photographs and trinkets are there, but the silver candlesticks are odd. They seem out of balance and are placed too close together. It's Clarissa's urn. They stood on either side of it, but now there's an empty space. Charles must have moved it. But where to? He wouldn't have thrown it out, that's for sure. To boost my confidence, I take another sip of wine and whisper, as if it's too harsh to say out loud, "What's happened to the urn?" His thumb strokes my palm, and he crosses his legs. I smile, encouraging him to speak, but inside my stomach flutters. Am I about to destroy the tranquility of the love we share?
You're quite right. I really must make sure I come to bed, rather than falling asleep on the sofa downstairs.
But what are you doing down here? I came down last night, and you weren't anywhere to be seen. Then I saw a light shine in the garden, from the summer house. You can't be playing piano at 2 in the morning. He drops my hand and stands.
I'll take Jack out for a walk. Then afterward, we can settle down in peace to watch the film. I'll just run to the bathroom first. That's if you don't mind.
Jack clambers down from the sofa and runs around Charles's feet, tail wagging at the mention of a walk, and Charles tickles him under his chin. Yes, of course. That's fine. He leans over and pecks a kiss on my cheek and heads upstairs. My legs tense, and I wait a minute, then run to the hall. He always leaves his keys there. They jingle together as I fumble through them, searching for the right one. Which one is it? The toilet flushes. I jump and they clatter to the floor. I pick them up and start again. His footsteps on the staircase tell me that he's coming back down. It must be the gold one. The others are the same as mine. I pull it from the ring and run back and settle on the sofa, the key pressed tight in my hand.
I might go for a pint with Robert while I'm out,
Charles says. Great, then I've time for a bath before you're back. I wave goodbye and close the door as he tugs Jack down the driveway. Am I really going to go through with this? It's wrong to invade his privacy. I would hate it if he did that to me. But I really have to find out what's going on here, to understand why he leaves me alone so much and evades my questions. But most of all, is Clarissa's urn in there? A future wife has a right to know. I cross over the lawn and walk down past the willow tree, the bench, and the forget-me-nots. I hesitate outside on the veranda. There's still time to change my mind. But then I'd never know. I turn the key in the lock. It clicks. My lips dry. I moisten them with a sweep of my tongue and open the door. The room's dark. Charles explained the piano has to be protected from direct sunlight as it can affect the tuning. So the Venetian blind on the window is always closed. There's a faint smell of mildew and dead flowers. It hasn't seen fresh air in a while. I switch on the light and step back in shock. There are photographs of Clarissa on every surface, including the walls. He must have rescued them from the skip. She hasn't vanished at all. She's present, here in this perverse mausoleum, and he spends his time in here, beside her.
Why? Can't he embrace the love in front of him, the one that's alive?
The photographs are going in the bin, even if I've to put them there myself. We'll discuss it when he comes back from the pub, and if he can't agree, I'm leaving. I can't live with this madness anymore. But it won't come to that. Charles is kind. Maybe we happened too soon, and he needed longer to let go. He must have found it so hard, and then hid all this from me because he was ashamed of his actions. I'll help him. We'll put an end to this. But should I say I've seen it, or give him more time? Where's the urn? It must be in here too. Maybe we could end this madness by scattering her ashes at sea. He did say they used to walk the dogs at the beach. It would be the perfect resting place. I tilt my head to one side. There's something on the sofa. A piece of paper. An empty glass sits on the floor beside it, as if Charles has sat there many times with a whiskey and read it. I chew the inside of my cheek. It couldn't be. Could it? Is this the letter? The one that made Charles cry all those months ago? I walk over and pick it up. I scan the salutation. Your forever wife, Clarissa. There's a tightness in my chest as I begin to read.
Chapter 36. Ronnie, Liverpool.
And then there's ludus, meaning playful love. Like when you have a one-night stand or a casual thing. And storge is the kind of love you have for your mum or dad. And
will you shut the fuck up about Greeks and their stupid definitions of love, Graham?
I shove a piece of toast in my mouth and pull on my coat. He laughs and picks up his briefcase.
I'm just saying that there are different kinds of love, that's all. That one word doesn't cover everything.
No, you're trying to wriggle out of seeing you loved me. I'm not dumb.
It's been months, and he's never said it again.
Instead, all I get is this boring bullshit about what someone said about love 2,000 years ago. What has that got to do with anything?
I've obviously not won yet, because he's still a shifty bastard. Ludus and Storge and the rest of that crap is some kind of strategy. I just haven't worked out what yet. But I'll succeed in the end.
You all set for the big day, Ron. This is the promotion you always dreamed of.
Looking at his image in the glass, he adjusts his hair. Checks from every angle. He loves that mirror more than me. Someday I might smash it. With a swing on my hip, I nudge him out of the way.
You're obsessed with how you look.
I check my own reflection. Hair is fine. I bare my teeth. Lipstick too. Hands land on my shoulders. He twirls me around to face him.
You've got this. You're tenacious and you know your stuff. Inside out. They'll be lucky to have you. Go show them what you're made of.
This is what gets to me. One minute he's talking shit about Greeks, and the next he's my rock, the one person who truly has my back. But what about the presentation? I'm not sure it's clear.
He leans in and kisses me on the nose. There's something tender about being kissed there. More protective and sweet than sexual. It's like how a father might kiss his daughter.
I'm not going there. Not today of all days. It's shit hot, Ron. We worked on it all night. You're gonna blow them away.
He's right. We sat all night together, writing and rewriting and refining, his sharp commentary helping me, guiding me.
I shrug.
He runs his hands through my hair and pulls my mouth to his. I push him away.
What the fuck are you doing, Graham? You're messing up my hair?
He throws his hands up and backs a wee, laughing.
Sorry, I got carried away. I'll save it for later.
I raise my eyebrows. Graham can bring any situation back to sex. But at least it means he still likes me. Or am I just more easily available? A taxi horn blasts from the street. There used to be a time when the driver would leave his car and knock gently on your door, but not anymore. The world's in too much of a hurry now for such manners. Lifting a hand to my mouth, I blow Graham a kiss and head out. Briefcase in hand, he follows. Good luck, he shouts, and then sets off along the pavement for work. The taxi driver asks where to, and we drive off. The call had come last Friday, asking me if I would be interested in taking over a large failing school. I was more than ready for a new challenge, so I'd agreed to be interviewed today. If I get the job, it will be a huge jump in salary and a boost to my confidence. Even as a head teacher, I feel like an imposter in boardrooms cramped with men from the right schools with the right accents. But if they make me an offer and I relocate to a different city, what will it mean for Graham and me? A group of adults stand at the school gates, puffing away on cigarettes. Weeds grow on either side of the neglected driveway, and paint peels from the signage. The kids deserve much more than this. I pay the driver, ignoring the urge to jump back in and go somewhere else. But then, isn't this the only thing I'm good at? The one thing I excel in?
It's rough here. Better watch your bags, love.
He winks. Just at my street, then? It's much easier to polish a turd than people think, you know. He laughs.
You'll need a big duster for this place.
I smile. These fuckers haven't met me yet. They're going to discover it's a life-changing experience. Fried chicken sizzles from the kitchen, paprika drifting along the air to welcome me home. Graham's a fabulous cook, but every surface will be covered in gloop. Of course, he'll have a perfect dab of flour on his nose for me to kiss away. He does it every time. It was funny at first, but it's just one of his signature moves to go along with the recipe. I slip out of my heels and stretch my feet. Bliss. As I enter the living room, a tingle of apprehension crawls up the back of my neck. Candles burn from every direction, and the table is decorated with a white tablecloth and rose petals. A silver bucket filled with champagne and crushed ice stands beside it. A card is propped against a wine glass, my name circled within a love heart. It's unusual for him to go to so much effort. Normally we eat from trays while watching a film. Something is going on. He's either seeking forgiveness for something he's done, or battering me up for what's to come.
Hey, how'd it go, baby?
His arms wrap around me, and I rise on my toes and lick the flower from his nose, as expected. A sweep of my arm takes in the room with its decorations. What's all this in aid of? His bottom lip droops out, and he fakes a sob.
You're such a hard woman to please. Don't you like it?
I like it. But what's the emotional cost of my enjoyment? Nothing comes without motive from Graham. It wouldn't surprise me if some random nude jumped out of a cupboard to join us in a threesome.
Chill, Ronnie. I thought I'd show you how proud I am of you. I wanted you to know I'm here for you, no matter the outcome today. That's it. Nothing else.
He walks back to the kitchen, shaking his head, and a pang of guilt twists my stomach. I'm being a bitch. He's doing a nice thing here. Yet instead of thanking him, I'm investigating him like a criminal. Any other girlfriend would have been happy by this show of solidarity. But then, Graham isn't the typical boyfriend. and I've been stabbed in the heart too many times in the past to fall into the traps of grand gestures. I no longer mistake hearts and flowers for sincerity. Graham returns with platters of fried chicken and herby rice, which he places in the centre of the table with a smile. His moods never settle into a long-drawn sulk. Everything is always too easy and light to shake his world with any real depth. Nothing matters to him. The only thing of real substance is himself. When the first bite of salty chicken crunches in my mouth and a drip of grease runs from my lips, a moan of pleasure escapes.
"It's good, huh?"
he says. I nod my agreement, and as he offers me a napkin, our hands touch for the briefest of moments. It's enough for our eyes to catch and for my guard to soften. They offered me the job, and I accepted. It will mean moving away, but I knew that anyway. This is it. This is the turning point. If I transfer somewhere else, what about us? I fill my mouth with a spoonful of rice, and the words hang heavy in the air between us. It won't be long before the full implications land on his shoulders. Graham lifts a napkin, cleans his hands, and stands. With a smile, he lifts me from the chair and spins me around in the air. I knew they'd see you like I do. I laugh and tap his back. Put me down, Graham. I'm not a little girl. I hate being spun around like a child. Something about it is so belittling, and it makes me queasy. He pours champagne and toasts my success. I'm relieved he's happy for me, and is proud of what I've accomplished. But he hasn't said anything yet about what our future together will be like. He grabs the card from the table and thrusts it into my hands. He's always believed in me since the first day we met. But if I don't find out where the promotion leaves us, I'll overthink it all night.
Now, don't go crazy, Ronnie, but...
He's concentrating on his glass, spinning the champagne around inside. A wave of heat rushes to my head. If it's him or my career, then the career will always win. It's the only part of my life that's dependable and solid. There's just no competition.
But you know how I've been going on about the Greeks and their definitions of the different types of love.
What the fuck? Not this again. I nod and take a slug of champagne, wishing it was something stronger, like a double vodka.
The Greeks have it all sussed. My religious upbringing was stifling. All the rules and door knocking. There was only one truth about love, and to think otherwise was eternal damnation. But we don't have to fit into that mould. We can make our own rules.
His foot taps against the floor. Where's he going with this? I resist the urge to roll my eyes as he rubs the back of his neck and exhales.
I was scared to tell you I love you, in case everything changed. In case it meant we were put in a cage and the lock on the door engaged. But that doesn't have to be us. We don't need to be trapped by love. We'll be scholars. Approach it from the broader sense, like the Greeks.
My hands stroke my necklace. My head tilts to the left. Let him finish. Don't interrupt.
I mean, we're in love, but we can still be us. Still be playful with others, but realise it doesn't affect the many kinds of love we have for each other.
He takes a sip of his drink and places it down. From behind the cushion, he retrieves a Tiffany blue box and kneels in front of me. I press my fist to my mouth and step back. Tears rush to my eyes. What's he doing?
Marry me, Ronnie. Let's live our own kind of love.
My mouth drops open. He laughs and reaches for my hand. I let him take it. Then my voice returns. I haven't even met your parents.
They won't be a part of this. Their religion would forbid it. It will just be us. We'll marry here in Liverpool, or in our new place, after we get settled. I'll come with you. We'll get a house together. I can work from anywhere.
The proposal spins inside my head. I can't wait to undo the white ribbon to see what type of ring he chose. But is this what the Greek shit was all about? All that rubbish about how many different forms of love exist? Just an academic excuse to swing his dick? His declaration of love doesn't mean a thing. When will he ever grow up from the teenage sow your oats crap? It's pathetic. Every man wants a woman to come home to and want to fuck down a dark alley. But at some point, they have to make a fucking choice. One or the other. They can't have burgers and steaks every day, the greedy bastards. I sigh. Maybe that's unfair. He's never had the freedom before. Not when all the rest of us did. And his true commitment is to me. Hasn't he just shown that with an engagement ring? Yes, he wants to have sex with other people. But his emotions and his loyalty remain solely with me. The game could have ended with me moving away, us breaking up. But instead, I've won. Not just won his love, but won a marriage proposal. And he'll never go behind my back. Not when he has a pardon. Graham will never leave me. He'll always be by my side, and one day, he'll get bored with all the sexual conquests. It's true. We'll have our own kind of love. Love that's based on honesty.
Ronnie.
I jump into his arms. Yes, yes, I'll marry you. I've not been for many years. Time softens the edges, but it's just a blister of emotions waiting to burst. A song, the way someone walks, the scent of a perfume, even the glimpse of a colour she once wore. And the pain seeps out to drown me. I don't talk about her. I can't. The agony's too raw. But I have to go back. I need to face her. Tell her that her daughter is getting married. Chapter 37. Nicky, Mondello. Gio stares silently out the window in the back seat of the car, still angry about our visit to Santa Rosalia. The rain, Paola and me dancing, men whistling from the bus and my red halter neck top. He doesn't want to go to the beach. I sit beside him, bare legs fused to the hot leather seat. I nudge closer to him, my skin stinging from its sudden release. He slides further away and continues to watch the countryside fly past. He's been like this for weeks, a big man sulking like a little boy. Filippo switches on the radio. "We need the musica," he says. It blares into life, and I sing along to the English lyrics, excited for a day out. But Gio stretches between the seats and switches it off. Such a big pig. I slump back and cross my arms across my chest. He's always spoiling my fun. He'd best snap out of it before we get to the beach, or there won't be much point. Slender tree branches skim over the car, and a few green leaves scatter into the sunroof and onto my lap. I caress them through my fingers, wishing things were better. Flashes of colour grab my attention, and I look up. An orange grove, just like the one when we first arrived, where Gio leapt out of the car, climbed into the trees, and brought me some to taste. I tap his arm. "Gio, the orange trees? Do you remember?" He glances over, takes in the trees swollen with fruit, and looks away. But not before the corner of a grin flashes on his face. "Don't you remember? It was so hot, and you opened the oranges and gave them to me, and it was such a relief to quench my thirst." He turns, his grin wide. "I was like the Tarzan," he says, and beats his chest.
I laugh, and he joins in. It's what you have to do with little boys. Talk them around, flatter their ego, and make them feel tall.
Filippo drops us off in town, and we stroll along the Strada Statale. It's so different from Portobello. Huge pastel houses line the street, all of them with high metal gates. Rich people protecting themselves from everyone else. On the other side of the road, palm trees line the pavement. People stroll along, hand in hand like us. Men in shorts and white t-shirts, women in bright strappy dresses. I smile as the breeze ruffles over my legs and arms. I'm just like them for once. The sea lures me closer. I slip from Gio's hand, skip along the sandy pavement and run through the trees. Gio calls me back.
No, Nikki, this beach not for you and me. This the private.
I screw up my nose. The people here are having fun, screaming and laughing in shimmering water, and I want to be part of it.
We go the public beach,
Gio says, and I wait until he catches me up, then follow. We amble past the string of coffee shops, bars and bakeries that sweeten the air with sugary scents, until Gio stops in front of a street vendor and I bump into the back of his legs. Stretching an arm above his shoulders to a rack full of sunglasses and inflatables, he grabs a pink hat from a hook, pays for it, then arranges it on top of my head.
This keep you safe,
he says, and plants a kiss on my forehead, which is now shaded under a wide floppy brim. I twirl around showing it off, a warmth in my belly that the sun didn't heat. He turns and leads us off the path and down a couple of steps onto glittering sand. Beach towels in vibrant colours are spread together, like the patchwork quilt my granny made back home. Weaving in and out of them, from one end of the beach to the other, a couple of guys selling ice-cold drinks chant Aranciata, Coca-Cola, Limonata. My tongue wets my dry lips. Bursts of laughter sprinkle around us as a group of teenagers leap into the sky to bat a bright yellow ball back over a high white net. The sea glistens behind them, the colour of turquoise, just like the photos I've seen in holiday brochures. Further out, where boats sail, bouncing on waves, it's a deeper blue, almost a navy. It shines and ripples in the sunshine, enticing me in, welcoming me home. Through clouds of suntan oil heavy with coconut and mango, we cross the sands and place our beach towels down next to each other. I jump up and down, excited. Gio laughs and sits down, spreads cream onto his hairy legs, sunglasses hiding the glances he throws around at all the pretty ladies. I've no time for any of that nonsense, and whip off my sandals. Toes curl in the heat of the sand, and a bliss runs through me that only the sea can offer. I moisten my lips, and the salt on my tongue tastes like freedom. Pulling my sundress over my head and throwing my hat to the sand, I dash in my red bikini to the water. In Scotland, the sea is always cold, even in summer. We whimper in, a piece of skin at a time. But here, it's like a warm hug that cradles you up. I close my eyes, float on my back, arms and legs stretched out like a starfish, and let the water renew me, replenish my soul. My hand hits something, and I squeal in fright. But it's only a shoal of tangerine fish swimming alongside me. Such a beautiful experience. It fills me with lightness. I might stay here forever. Be one with the waves. Even the chatter from the beach soothes my worries away, makes me feel a part of something special. A push, a pull. Something lunges from below the sea and capsizes me, tips me over face down, and pushes me deep into the water. I flap around, gulp a mouthful of sea, and scream. What's happening? Am I going to drown? Gio seizes me,
lifts me high in the air and splashes me back down.
Nikki, here come the sharky. Watch out, it eat you all up.
He laughs. Jew, you big idiot. I splash his face and he roars and splashes back. And soon we're like toddlers in a paddling pool, drenching each other, our shrieks mingling with the bustle from the shore until we tire ourselves out. Jumping onto his back, I wrap my arms around his neck, legs around his belly, and he clutches my ankles in his hands. Safe. Look, Gio. I point towards lemon paddle boats that sway on water further along from us. Can we hire one? Pretty please?
Let's go,
he says, and I wrap my arms tighter around him, feeling like a princess as he paddles us down. Giggling, cheeks sore with laughter, I poke Gio in the side. We can't make the boat go forward no matter how hard we try. It's him. He's paddling too fast, and even when I tell him to slow down, we just circle around like a couple of fools. Until, eventually, we get stuck in wet sand, and no matter what we do, we can't budge our way out. It's weird how others sail by us, perfectly fine. Maybe they balance each other out better than him and me. Throwing his hands in the air, Gio jumps overboard and swims up behind me.
You do the cycle, Nikki! We beat this!
Placing his palms on the back of the boat, he pushes hard. I wriggle in excitement as we glide off, finally leaving the shallows of the beach.
Wait me!
He shouts, and I giggle and throw a smile over my shoulder. Hurry up then, slow coach, and jump back in. Apartments jostle against each other, all slightly different shades of orange. Balconies with shuttered windows, keeping the heat out, overflow with plants. Their flowers of lilac and cream trail down to the street and cheer it up. Chatting loudly, families with pasta and wine sit outside small cafes. A group of old women dressed head to toe in black sits at the edge of the pavement, shelling crab. As we idle along, the open doorway of a shadow-lined shop reveals shelves of figurines and crockery and bric-a-brac. My feet dance in pleasure. Gio has money. I'm going to make the most of the moment. It's time to brighten up the flat and make it more like our home. Gio has already passed by, but I call him back and show him the shop. He groans, but I'm already making my way inside. Two men with bushy moustaches, it must be a thing with Italian men, are leaning on the frame of the door. Gio bustles over so that he passes between them before I do, and I sneak in behind. The men all exchange glances, but nothing is said. I can't be bothered with all the silly macho games. The shop is narrow, but its shelves stretch off forever with hidden treasure. It's a little piece of heaven, and I clap my hands in excitement and delve in. I'm rummaging among some pieces of fabric when Gio says,
Nikki, we're here for hours and hours. It's very long time, no?
He's talking rubbish. It hasn't even been half an hour. But he's getting fidgety, so I snatch at my choices, and he pays the shopkeepers, who are now standing behind a big old-fashioned till. We leave, and outside, the sun hits me like a sledgehammer. But I'm holding a few of my new things tight, and I don't even mind when Gio mutters about having to carry the rest back on the bus in this heat. I can't wait to show Paola all my new stuff. I keep changing my mind about where things should go, but it's such fun. Is the little white bookcase okay here, or would it look better over by the window? The flat already feels less of a dump, and I've only started doing it up. Imagine how pretty it will look in a few months. Deciding to leave the bookcase where it is, I stand back from it all and look around at my hard work. The painting of Mondello Beach on the wall looks gorgeous. On the dining table, like sand under sunlight, Spirals of shimmering gold sparkle from a large glass bowl. Perfect.
Nikki, enough of the decorating. You need get ready for christening.
Geo shouts from the bedroom. A scrunch at my nose. His nephew's christening. They're a big deal in Scotland, but here, in Sicily, the naming of a child is something else. It's sort of secret. No member of the family would dare miss it. I can't be bothered to visit them all, especially the father with his gloomy dark stares. I'd rather bathe here in all the sparkles. We walk along the street to the cream church. Crowds of people are already outside, and I can tell instantly I'm dressed wrong. All the women are in bright colours, short skirts, flashing silk scarves. I'm dressed like a nun, in a long black skirt and high-collared white blouse. Geo had insisted, and I'd gone along with it to keep the peace. Everyone files into the church, and I clasp Geo's hand and try to loiter at the back. There's a hush. Filippo holds a tiny bundle draped in white satin and lace, his wife by his side. Together, they step down the passageway between the pews. The priest is waiting at the font, watching them solemnly. At the altar, the priest lifts the baby into his arms. For the first time, I get a clear look. Thick black hair, red cherub lips, so tiny and innocent. Light from stained glass windows fall on her like a blessing from God. The ceremony begins. I can't follow everything that's said, but I take in the solemn faces of those around me and let their emotions draw me in. My mum would love this so much. The priest gives his final blessings, and now the pious expressions give way to cheering and clapping. Everyone rises and clusters around the baby, kissing cheeks, hugging and slapping backs. Then we all spill out into the church courtyard. Geo turns to me, wraps me up in his bear-like arms and kisses my neck. "We do this one day," he whispers. I nod, feeling fuzzy and warm inside. He takes my hand and we join the crowd as it meanders along the road to his father's house. Tony's home is like a fairy tale. In the garden outside, strings of tiny pale lights glint among the tree branches and lemons and oranges tang the air. The tinkle of glass is everywhere. It's magical, and my eyes fill with tears. His dad stands under a frangipani tree, greeting everyone, kissing all the men and women, welcoming them all in. I drift to the side of the garden in case he ignores me again. Geo has vanished, and without him beside me, I nibble at the skin around my fingers. All the conversation is in a language I don't fully understand. All the family members I've never met, but who are bonded by love. I shrink into the hedge. There's a wooden bandstand at the end of the garden. The musicians playing songs I don't recognise. Even a bit of Frank Sinatra would be better than this. I tap my foot on the pathway, so it appears as if I'm joining in. His face dead serious. Geo's dad appears, and I'm a bit frightened by his presence. The last time he even refused my handshake. My feet still, my fingers twined together behind my back. But then he smiles and lifts his right hand. I'm not sure what he means, but he nods encouragement, and so I put my fingers in his. He sweeps his arm around my waist and draws me into the centre of the garden, right in front of the band. Suddenly, the music makes sense. It might be old folk tunes, but the beat is simple. My feet follow his, and soon we're waltzing in the moonlight under the twinkling stars. He draws me closer to him, and in broken English, he whispers, "First, I know like you. But you good girl for the Geo. You keep him under, what you call it, the thumb. He has the need of that."
tilting my head back, I look up into his eyes and smile. It isn't the welcome I would have wanted, but it's something. He's happy someone is willing to say to Gio when enough is enough. We swirl around and eventually the song comes to an end and he lifts my hand to his mouth and plants a kiss there. The family breaks into applause. I've passed some kind of test. A girl, probably a cousin, pats my arm as I walk back to the comfort of the garden edges. There's a bounce in my step that wasn't there before. Dove Gio? I ask her. She scowls and points across the fairy lights in the shrubbery to a wooden shed set aside from the main house. The men, they there. But you no go. She laughs. But I'm dizzy with excitement. He missed the dance. He'd have been so proud. I run across the grass to the shed and grasp the door handle. I pause, heart fluttering with excitement. Gio is going to sweep me up into his arms when I tell him what's happened, and all the men will cheer. I bust my way inside. A small wooden table sits in the centre of the room. Half a dozen men are seated around it. There's a mountain of cash in the middle, and cards are strewn around its edges. An older man is drawing the money towards him, grinning widely. Gio has his head in his hands, moaning, his fingers scratching at his skin. I look at the cards. There are no casinos here, no way to reach the horse racing tracks, no convenient bookies for a fool to throw away all his money. But somehow, Gio has found a means. All those nights when he was supposed to be working extra shifts suddenly make sense. It wasn't work that called him. It was his disease, the mistress he couldn't reject. That's why we live in a pigsty with a cockroach infestation. That's why he never has any money. He hasn't changed. I tiptoe backward, pull the door closed behind me, and flee from the garden and Gio's lies.
Chapter 38. Mrs. Hawthorne, Edinburgh.
My dearest Charles, if you are reading this, I am long gone. No longer of this world, but in another place where you cannot reach me. Yet I am sorry to have left you all alone. I do hope that I battled death and didn't surrender to his call too easily, that you were proud of me in those last few days. But he was always going to win at some point. We both knew that. Thankfully, I went first, because to live without you would have been like living in my own personal hell. Forgive me for my selfishness, but you cannot imagine the torture your passing would have caused in every fibre of my being. You know I loved you deeply. It was there in every touch, every word, and it sits within every memory. Look for it, Charles, if you must. It's easy to find in the photographs of our life together. That girl, only 17, pirouetting on the stage, dizzy from all that glittered around her, but only ever needing the love of one man, the one that gave her the confidence to dance. You, my darling. That glance only the camera spied, that touch of my hand on your arm, that smile you missed. Look, Charles, look back, and you'll find it. Never doubt our love. Do keep playing piano, and if at times you feel it's too hard, or a song reminds you of our time together, think of me, and I'll be there right beside you, every time you need me. Play not for you, but for us, my love. Yesterday when you served me soup, I am so sorry I couldn't eat it. You turned your face to the side, to hide how tears had blinded your eyes. It reminded me of our first kiss. Do you remember it? You were so shy. I'd liked you for such a long time, but each time I gave you a hint, you missed it.
Therefore, I asked you to be my boyfriend. Your hands flew to cover your face, but I could still see the blush underneath. I leaned in, parted your palms, and kissed you. Right there on the school playground. And from that day onwards, it was just us. We ruled the world, Charles, you and I. But I am gone now. And what I say next will distress you. I do so with pain in my heart for the little boy that blushed and will shrivel with hurt. Please remember, it doesn't tarnish our love or how much I adore you, but I can't take it to my grave. So I present the facts. I had an affair. It's no one you know, and I take his name with me. It lasted 5 years. You were so busy with work, and I was disappearing into the role of the professor's wife. I used to be the star of the stage, the one adored by hundreds of fans every night, peonies thrown at my feet, my face on every poster, in every paper. But suddenly I was the understudy, wilting within the endless graduations, the banquets with dry academics, and the never-ending damp handshakes. I know it's a cliche to say that it meant nothing. But it didn't, Charles. You had so much, all that adoration. What was wrong with me having some too? I don't expect you to forgive me. I know that's an impossible thing to ask. I only ask you to understand. I know you've room in your heart for that. But if you can't, destroy this letter and throw all my possessions out into the cold. Burn our memories and curse me to the gods. However, if you do that, Charles, you deny the love between us. You cheapen it to the indiscretion of a silly affair. We were much more than that. We were the epitome of love. If you ever sense someone behind you, if you ever feel a hand rest on your arm, or hear a sigh of longing, of loss, it will be me, Charles, watching for you, waiting for you. For how could I ever truly leave my own dear boy? I'll be with you, always and forever. Remember us, and if you doubt us, look for the love. You'll find it. Your everlasting wife, Clarissa, the most beautiful girl in the world.